Mr. Reardon's critique, and couldn't have agreed with it more. An assessment at one point in time has little value for understanding someone's ability, let alone their potential to succeed in the future. It was disturbing how many teachers thought otherwise, and that was the point of our study. The idea that one evaluation can measure you forever is what creates the urgency for those with the fixed mindset. That's why they must succeed perfectly and immediately. Who can afford the luxury of trying to grow when everything is on the line right now? Is there another way to judge potential? NASA thought so. When they were soliciting applications for astronauts, they rejected people with pure histories of success and instead selected people who had had significant failures and bounced back from them. Jack Welch, the celebrated CEO of General Electric, chose executives on the basis of runway, their capacity for growth. And remember Marina Semyonova, the famed ballet teacher, who chose the students who were energized by criticism. They were all rejecting the idea of fixed ability and selecting instead for mindset. Proving you're special. When people with the fixed mindset opt for success over growth, what are they really trying to prove? That they're special, even superior. When we ask them, "When do you feel smart?" so many of them talked about times they felt like a special person, someone who was different from and better than other people. Until I discovered the mindsets and how they work, I too thought of myself as more talented than others, maybe even more worthy than others because of my endowments. The scariest thought, which I rarely entertained, was the possibility of being ordinary. This kind of thinking led me to need constant validation. Every comment, every look was meaningful. It registered on my intelligence scorecard, my attractiveness scorecard, my likability scorecard. If a day went well, I could bask in my high numbers. One bitter cold winter night, I went to the opera. That night, the opera was everything you hope for, and everyone stayed until the very end, not just the end of the opera, but through all the curtain calls. Then we all poured into the street and we all wanted taxis. I remember it clearly. It was after midnight, it was 7 degrees, there was a strong wind, and as time went on, I became more and more miserable. There I was, part of an undifferentiated crowd. What chance did I have? Suddenly, a taxi pulled up right next to me. The handle of the back door lined up perfectly with my hand, and as I entered, the driver announced, "You were different." I lived for those moments. Not only was I special, it could be detected from a distance. The self-esteem movement encourages this kind of thinking and has even invented devices to help confirm your superiority. I recently came across an ad for such a product. Two of my friends send me an illustrated list each year of the top 10 things they didn't get me for Christmas. From January through November, they clip candidate items from catalogs or download them from the internet. In December, they select the winners. One of my all-time favorites is the pocket toilet, which you fold up and return to your pocket after using. This year, my favorite was the "I Love Me" mirror, a mirror with "I Love Me" in huge capital letters written across the bottom half. By looking into it, you can administer the message to yourself and not wait for the outside world to announce your specialness. Of course, the mirror is harmless enough. The problem is when special begins to mean better than others. A more valuable human being, a superior person, an entitled person. Special, superior, entitled. John McEnroe had a fixed mindset. He believed that talent was all. He did not love to learn. He did not thrive on challenges. When the going got rough, he often folded. As a result, by his own admission, he did not fulfill his potential. But his talent was so great that he was the number one tennis player in the world for 4 years. Here he tells us what it was like to be number one. McEnroe used sawdust to absorb the sweat on his hands during a match. This time the sawdust was not to his liking, so he went over to the can of sawdust and knocked it over with his racket. His agent, Gary, came dashing over to find out what was wrong. "You call that sawdust?" I said. I was actually screaming at him.
The sawdust was ground too fine. This looks like rat poison. Can't you get anything right? So Gary ran out and 20 minutes later came back with a fresh can of coarser sawdust and $20 less in his pocket. He'd had to pay a union employee to grind up a 2x4. This is what it was like to be number one. He goes on to tell us about how he once threw up all over a dignified Japanese lady who was hosting him. The next day she bowed, apologized to him, and presented him with a gift. This, McEnroe proclaims, is also what it was like to be number one. Everything was about you. Did you get everything you need? Is everything okay? We'll pay you this, we'll do that, we'll kiss your behind. You only have to do what you want. Your reaction to anything else is, get the hell out of here. For a long time, I didn't mind it a bit. Would you? So let's see. If you're successful, you're better than other people. You get to abuse them and have them grovel. In the fixed mindset, this is what can pass for self-esteem. As a contrast, let's look at Michael Jordan, growth-minded athlete par excellence, whose greatness is regularly proclaimed by the world. Superman, God in person, Jesus in tennis shoes. If anyone has reason to think of himself as special, it's he. But here's what he said when his return to basketball caused a huge commotion. I was shocked with the level of intensity my coming back to the game created. People were praising me like I was a religious cult or something. It was very embarrassing. I'm a human being like everyone else. Jordan knew how hard he had worked to develop his abilities. He was a person who had struggled and grown, not a person who was inherently better than others. Tom Wolfe, in The Right Stuff, describes the elite military pilots who eagerly embrace the fixed mindset. Having passed one rigorous test after another, they think of themselves as special, as people who were born smarter and braver than other people. But Chuck Yeager, the hero of The Right Stuff, begged to differ. There is no such thing as a natural-born pilot. Whatever my aptitude or talents, becoming a proficient pilot was hard work. Really a lifetime's learning experience. The best pilots fly more than the others. That's why they're the best. Like Michael Jordan, he was a human being. He just stretched himself farther than most. In summary, people who believe in fixed traits feel an urgency to succeed, and when they do, they may feel more than pride. They may feel a sense of superiority, since success means their fixed traits are better than other people's. However, lurking behind that self-esteem of the fixed mindset is a simple question. If you're somebody when you're successful, what are you when you're unsuccessful? Mindsets change the meaning of failure. The Martins worshipped their 3-year-old Robert and always bragged about his feats. There had never been a child as bright and creative as theirs. Then Robert did something unforgivable. He didn't get into the number one preschool in New York. After that, the Martins cooled toward him. They didn't talk about him the same way, and they didn't treat him with the same pride and affection. He was no longer their brilliant little Robert. He was someone who had discredited himself and shamed them. At the tender age of 3, he was a failure. As a New York Times article points out, failure has been transformed from an action. I failed, to an identity. I am a failure. This is especially true in the fixed mindset. When I was a child, I too worried about meeting Robert's fate. In 6th grade, I was the best speller in my school. The principal wanted me to go to a citywide competition, but I refused. In 9th grade, I excelled in French, and my teacher wanted me to enter a citywide competition. Again, I refused. Why would I risk turning from a success into a failure, from a winner into a loser? Ernie Els, the great golfer, worried about this too. Els finally won a major tournament after a 5-year dry spell, in which match after match slipped away from him. What if he had lost this tournament too? I would have been a different person, he tells us. He would have been a loser. Each April, when the skinny envelopes, the rejection letters, arrive from colleges, countless failures are created coast to coast. Thousands of brilliant young scholars become the girl who didn't get into Princeton or the boy who didn't get into Stanford.
defining moments. Even in the growth mindset, failure can be a painful experience. But it doesn't define you. It's a problem to be faced, dealt with, and learned from. Jim Marshall, former defensive player for the Minnesota Vikings, relates what could easily have made him into a failure. In a game against the San Francisco 49ers, Marshall spotted the football on the ground. He scooped it up and ran for a touchdown as the crowd cheered. But he ran the wrong way. He scored for the wrong team and on national television. It was the most devastating moment of his life. The shame was overpowering. But during halftime, he thought, if you make a mistake, you gotta make it right. I realized I had a choice. I could sit in my misery or I could do something about it. Pulling himself together for the second half, he played some of his best football ever and contributed to his team's victory. Nor did he stop there. He spoke to groups. He answered letters that poured in from people who finally had the courage to admit their own shameful experiences. He heightened his concentration during games. Instead of letting the experience define him, he took control of it. He used it to become a better player and, he believes, a better person. In the fixed mindset, however, the loss of oneself to failure can be a permanent, haunting trauma. Bernard Loiseau was one of the top chefs in the world. Only a handful of restaurants in all of France receive the supreme rating of 3 stars from the Guide Michelin, the most respected restaurant guide in Europe. His was one of them. Around the publication of the 2003 Guide Michelin, however, Mr. Loiseau committed suicide. He had lost 2 points in another guide, going from a 19 out of 20 to a 17 in the Gaumont Michelin. And there were rampant rumors that he would lose one of his 3 stars in the new Guide. Although he did not, the idea of failure had possessed him. Loiseau had been a pioneer. He was one of the first to advance the nouveau cuisine, trading the traditional butter and cream sauces of French cooking for the brighter flavors of the foods themselves. A man of tremendous energy, he was also an entrepreneur. Besides his 3-star restaurant in Burgundy, he had created 3 eateries in Paris, numerous cookbooks, and a line of frozen foods. "I'm like Yves Saint Laurent," he told people. "I do both haute couture and ready-to-wear." A man of such talent and originality could easily have planned for a satisfying future, with or without the 2 points or the 3rd star. In fact, the director of the Gaumont Michelin said it was unimaginable that their rating could have taken his life. But in the fixed mindset, it is imaginable. Their lower rating gave him a new definition of himself. Failure has been. It's striking what counts as failure in the fixed mindset. So on a lighter note, my success is your failure. Last summer, my husband and I went to a dude ranch, something very novel since neither of us had ever made contact with a horse. One day, we signed up for a lesson in fly fishing. It was taught by a wonderful 80-year-old cowboy-type fisherman who showed us how to cast the fishing line and then turned us loose. We soon realized that he had not taught us how to recognize when the trout bit the lure. They don't tug on the line. You have to watch for a bubble in the water. What to do when the trout bit the lure, tug upward, or how to reel the trout in if by some miracle we got that far. Pull the fish along the water, do not hoist it into the air. Well, time passed, the mosquitoes bit, but not so the trout. None of the dozen or so of us made the slightest progress. Suddenly, I hit the jackpot. Some careless trout bit hard on my lure, and the fisherman, who happened to be right there, talked me through the rest. I had me a rainbow trout. Reaction number 1. My husband David came running over, beaming with pride and saying, "Life with you is so exciting." Reaction number 2. That evening when we came into the dining room for dinner, 2 men came up to my husband and said, "David, how are you coping?" David looked at them blankly. He had no idea what they were talking about. Of course he didn't. He was the one who thought my catching the fish was exciting. But I knew exactly what they meant. They had expected him to feel diminished, and they went on to make it clear that that's exactly what my success had done to them. Shirk, cheat, blame. Not a recipe for success. Beyond how traumatic a setback can be in the fixed mindset, this mindset gives you no recipe for overcoming it. If failure means you lack competence or potential, that you are a failure, Where do you go from there? In one study, seventh graders told us how they would respond to an academic failure, a poor test grade in a new course. Those with the growth mindset, no big surprise, said they would study harder for the next test. But those with the fixed mindset said they would study less for the next test. If you don't have the ability, why waste your time? And, they said, they would seriously consider cheating. If you don't have the ability, they thought, you just have to look for another way. What's more, instead of trying to learn from and repair their failures, people with the fixed mindset may simply try to repair their self-esteem. For example, they may go looking for people who are even worse off than they are. College students, after doing poorly on a test, were given a chance to look at tests of other students. Those in the growth mindset looked at the tests of people who had done far better than they had. As usual, they wanted to correct their deficiency. But students in the fixed mindset chose to look at the tests of people who had done really poorly. That was their way of feeling better about themselves. Jim Collins tells, in Good to Great, of a similar thing in the corporate world. As Procter & Gamble surged into the paper goods business, Scott Paper, which was then the leader, just gave up. Instead of mobilizing themselves and putting up a fight, they said, "Oh well, at least there are people in the business worse off than we are." Another way people with the fixed mindset try to repair their self-esteem after a failure is by assigning blame or making excuses. Let's return to John McEnroe. It was never his fault. One time he lost a match because he had a fever. One time he had a backache. One time he fell victim to expectations. Another time to the tabloids. One time he lost to a friend because the friend was in love and he wasn't. One time he ate too close to the match. One time he was too chunky. Another time too thin. One time it was too cold. Another time too hot. One time he was undertrained. Another time overtrained. His most agonizing loss, and the one that still keeps him up nights, was his loss in the 1984 French Open. Why did he lose after leading Evan Lendl 2-0? According to McEnroe, it wasn't his fault. An NBC cameraman had taken off his headset, and a noise started coming from the side of the court. Not his fault. So he didn't train to improve his ability to concentrate or his emotional control. John Wooden, the legendary basketball coach, says you aren't a failure until you start to blame. What he means is that you can still be in the process of learning from your mistakes until you deny them. When Enron, the energy giant, failed, toppled by a culture of arrogance, whose fault was it? "Not mine," insisted Jeffrey Skilling, the CEO and resident genius. It was the world's fault. The world did not appreciate what Enron was trying to do. What about the Justice Department's investigation into massive corporate deception? A witch hunt. Jack Welch, the growth-minded CEO, had a completely different reaction to one of General Electric's fiascos. In 1986, General Electric bought Kidder Peabody, a Wall Street investment banking firm. Soon after the deal closed, Kidder Peabody was hit with a big insider trading scandal. A few years later, calamity struck again in the form of Joseph Jett, a trader who made a bunch of fictitious trades to the tune of hundreds of millions to pump up his bonus. Welch phoned 14 of his top GE colleagues to tell them the bad news and to apologize personally. "I blamed myself for the disaster," Welch said. Mindset and depression. Maybe Bernard Loiseau, the French chef, was just depressed. Were you thinking that? As a psychologist and an educator, I'm vitally interested in depression. It runs wild on college campuses, especially in February and March. The winter is not over, the summer is not in sight, work has piled up, and relationships are often frayed. Yet it's been clear to me for a long time that different students handle depression in dramatically different ways. Some let everything slide. Others, though feeling wretched, hang on. They drag themselves to class, keep up with their work, and take care of themselves, so that when they feel better, their lives are intact. Not long ago, we decided to see whether mindsets play a role in this difference. To find out, we measured students' mindsets and then had them keep an online diary for 3 weeks in February and March. Every day they answered questions about their mood, their activities, and how they were coping with problems. Here's what we discovered. First, the students with the fixed mindset had higher levels of depression. Our analysis showed that this was because they ruminated over their problems and setbacks, essentially tormenting themselves with the idea that the setbacks meant they were incompetent or unworthy. It just kept circulating in my head, "You're a dope." I just couldn't let go of the thought that this made me less of a man. Again, failures labeled them and left them no route to success. And the more depressed they felt, the more they let things go, the less they took action to solve their problems. For example, they didn't study what they needed to, they didn't hand in their assignments on time, and they didn't keep up with their chores. Although students with the fixed mindset showed more depression, there were still plenty of people with the growth mindset who felt pretty miserable, this being peak season for depression. And here we saw something really amazing. The more depressed people with the growth mindset felt, the more they took action to confront their problems, the more they made sure to keep up with their schoolwork, and the more they kept up with their lives. The worse they felt, the more determined they became. In fact, from the way they acted, it might have been hard to know how despondent they were. Here is a story a young man told me. I was a freshman, and it was the first time I had been away from home. Everyone was a stranger, the courses were hard, and as the year wore on, I felt more and more depressed. Eventually, it reached a point where I could hardly get out of bed in the morning. But every day, I forced myself to get up, shower, shave, and do whatever it was I needed to do. One day, I really hit a low point, and I decided to ask for help. So I went to the teaching assistant in my psychology course and asked for her advice. "Are you going to your classes?" she asked. "Yes," I replied. "Are you keeping up with your reading?" "Yes." "Are you doing okay on your exams?" "Yes." "Well," she informed me, "then you're not depressed." Yes, he was depressed, but he was coping the way people in the growth mindset tend to cope, with determination. Doesn't temperament have a lot to do with it? Aren't some people sensitive by nature, while others just let things roll off their backs? Temperament certainly plays a role, but mindset is the most important part of the story. When we taught people the growth mindset, it completely changed the way they reacted to their depressed mood. The worse they felt, the more motivated they became, and the more they confronted the problems that faced them. In short, when people believe in fixed traits, they are always in danger of being measured by a failure. It can define them in a permanent way. Smart or talented as they may be, this mindset seems to rob them of their coping resources. When people believe their basic qualities can be developed, failures may still hurt, but failures don't define them. And if abilities can be expanded, if change and growth are possible, then there are still many paths to success. Mindsets change the meaning of effort. As children, we were given a choice between the talented but erratic hare and the plodding but steady tortoise. The lesson was supposed to be that slow and steady wins the race. But really, did any of us ever want to be the tortoise? No, we just wanted to be a less foolish hare. We wanted to be as swift as the wind and a bit more strategic, say not taking quite so many snoozes before the finish line. After all, everyone knows you have to show up in order to win. The story of the tortoise and the hare, in trying to put forward the power of effort, gave effort a bad name. It reinforced the image that effort is for the plodders, and suggested that in rare instances, when talented people dropped the ball, the plodder could sneak through. The little engine that could, the saggy baggy elephant, and the scruffy tugboat, they were cute, they were often overmatched, and we were happy for them when they succeeded. In fact, to this day I remember how fond I was of those little creatures, or machines, but no way did I identify with them. The message was, if you're fortunate enough to be the runt of the litter, if you lack endowment, you don't have to be an utter failure. You can be a sweet, adorable little slogger, and maybe, if you really work at it and withstand all the scornful onlookers, even a success. Thank you very much, I'll take the endowment. The problem was that these stories made it into an either-or. Either you have ability or you expend effort. And this is part of the fixed mindset. Effort is for those who don't have the ability. People with the fixed mindset tell us, if you have to work at something, you must not be good at it. They add, things come easily to people who are true geniuses. I was a young assistant professor in the psychology department at the University of Illinois. Late one night, I was passing the psychology building and noticed that the lights were on in some faculty offices. Some of my colleagues were working late. They must not be as smart as I am, I thought to myself. It never occurred to me that they might be just as smart and more hard-working. For me, it was either or, and it was clear I valued the either over the or. Malcolm Gladwell, the author and New Yorker writer, has suggested that as a society we value natural, effortless accomplishment over achievement through effort. We endow our heroes with superhuman abilities that led them inevitably toward their greatness. It's as if Midori popped out of the womb fiddling, Michael Jordan dribbling, and Picasso doodling. This captures the fixed mindset perfectly, and it's everywhere. A report from researchers at Duke University sounds an alarm about the anxiety and depression among female undergraduates who aspire to effortless perfection. They believe they should display perfect beauty, perfect womanhood, and perfect scholarship, all without trying, or at least without appearing to try. Americans aren't the only people who disdain effort. French executive Pierre Chevalier says, "We are not a nation of effort. After all, if you have savoir-faire, a mixture of know-how and cool, you do things effortlessly." People with the growth mindset, however, believe something very different. For them, even geniuses have to work hard for their achievements. And what's so heroic, they would say, about having a gift? They may appreciate endowment, but they admire effort. For no matter what your ability is, effort is what ignites that ability and turns it into accomplishment. Seabiscuit. Here was a horse who was so broken, he was supposed to be put to sleep. In fact, here was a whole team of people, the jockey, the owner, the trainer, who were damaged in one way or another. Yet through their dogged determination and against all odds, they transformed themselves into winners. A down-and-out nation saw this horse and rider as a symbol of what could be accomplished through grit and spirit. Equally moving is the parallel story about Seabiscuit's author, Laura Hillenbrand. Felled in her college years by severe, recurrent chronic fatigue that never went away, she was often unable to function. Yet something in the story of the horse who could gripped and inspired her so that she was able to write a heartfelt, magnificent story about the triumph of will. The book was a testament to Seabiscuit's triumph, and her own equally. Seen through the lens of the growth mindset, these are stories about the transformative power of effort. The power of effort to change your ability and to change you as a person. But filtered through the fixed mindset, it's a great story about three men and a horse, all with deficiencies, who had to try very hard. High effort, the big risk. From the point of view of the fixed mindset, effort is only for people with deficiencies. And when people already know they're deficient, they have nothing to lose by trying. But if your claim to fame is not having any deficiencies, if you're considered a genius, a talent, or a natural, then you have a lot to lose. Effort can reduce you. Nadia Salerno Sonnenberg made her violin debut at the age of 10 with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Yet when she arrived at Juilliard to study with Dorothy DeLay, the great violin teacher, she had a repertoire of awful habits. Her fingerings and bowings were awkward, and she held her violin in the wrong position, but she refused to change. After several years, she saw the other students catching up and even surpassing her, and by her late teens, she had a crisis of confidence. "I was used to success, to the prodigy label in newspapers, and now I felt like a failure. This prodigy was afraid of trying. Everything I was going through boiled down to fear, fear of trying and failing. If you go to an audition and don't really try, if you're not really prepared, if you didn't work as hard as you could have and you don't win, you have an excuse. Nothing is harder than saying, 'I gave it my all, and it wasn't good enough.'" The idea of trying and still failing, of leaving yourself without excuses is the worst fear within the fixed mindset, and it haunted and paralyzed her. She had even stopped bringing her violin to her lesson. Then one day, after years of patience and understanding, DeLay told her, "Listen, if you don't bring your violin next week, I'm throwing you out of my class." Salerno Sonnenberg thought she was joking, but DeLay rose from the couch and calmly informed her, "I'm not kidding. If you are going to waste your talent, I don't want to be a part of it. This has gone on long enough." Why is effort so terrifying? There are two reasons. One is that in the fixed mindset, great geniuses are not supposed to need it, so just needing it casts a shadow on your ability. The second is that, as Nadia suggests, it robs you of all your excuses. Without effort, you can always say, "I could have been, fill in the blank." But once you try, you can't say that anymore. Someone once said to me, "I could have been Yo-Yo Ma." If she had really tried for it, she wouldn't have been able to say that. Salerno Sonnenberg was terrified of losing DeLay. She finally decided that trying and failing, an honest failure, was better than the course she had been on, and so she began training with DeLay for an upcoming competition. For the first time, she went all out, and, by the way, won. Now she says, "This is something I know for a fact. You have to work hardest for the things you love most, and when it's music you love, you're in for the fight of your life." Fear of effort can happen in relationships too, as it did with Amanda, a dynamic and attractive young woman. "I had a lot of crazy boyfriends. A lot. They ranged from unreliable to inconsiderate. How about a nice guy for once?" my best friend Carla always said. It was like, "You deserve better." So then Carla fixed me up with Rob, a guy from her office. He was great, not just on day one. I loved it. It was like, oh my God, a guy who actually shows up on time. Then it became serious and I freaked. I mean, this guy really liked me, but I couldn't stop thinking about how, if he really knew me, he might get turned off. I mean, what if I really, really tried and it didn't work? I guess I couldn't take that risk. Low effort, the big risk. In the growth mindset, it's almost inconceivable to want something badly, to think you have a chance to achieve it, and then do nothing about it. When it happens, the "I could have been" is heartbreaking, not comforting. There were few American women in the 1930s through 1950s who were more successful than Clare Boothe Luce. She was a famous author and playwright. She was elected to Congress twice, and she was ambassador to Italy. "I don't really understand the word success," she has said. "I know people use it about me, but I don't understand it." Her public life and private tragedies kept her from getting back to her greatest love, writing for the theater. She had great success with plays like The Women, but it just wouldn't do for a political figure to keep penning tart, sexy comedies. For her, politics did not provide the personal creative effort she valued most, and looking back, she couldn't forgive herself for not pursuing her passion for theater. "I often thought," she said, "that if I were to write an autobiography, my title would be The Autobiography of a Failure." Billie Jean King says it's all about what you want to look back and say. I agree with her. You can look back and say, "I could have been," polishing your unused endowments like trophies. Or you can look back and say, "I gave my all for the things I valued." Think about what you want to look back and say. Then choose your mindset. Turning knowledge into action. Sure, people with the fixed mindset have read the books that say success is about being your best self, not about being better than others. Failure is an opportunity, not a condemnation. Effort is the key to success. But they can't put this into practice because their basic mindset, their belief in fixed traits, is telling them something entirely different. That success is about being more gifted than others. That failure does measure you. And that effort is for those who can't make it on talent. Questions and answers. At this point, you probably have questions. Let me see if I can answer some of them. Question. If people believe their qualities are fixed and they have shown themselves to be smart or talented, why do they have to keep proving it? After all, when the prince proved his bravery, he and the princess lived happily ever after. He didn't have to go out and slay a dragon every day.
Why don't people with the fixed mindset prove themselves and then live happily ever after? Because every day new and larger dragons come along, and as things get harder, maybe the ability they proved yesterday is not up to today's task. Maybe they were smart enough for algebra, but not calculus. Maybe they were a good enough pitcher for the minor leagues, but not the majors. Maybe they were a good enough writer for their school newspaper, but not the New York Times. So they're racing to prove themselves over and over, but where are they going? To me, they're often running in place, amassing countless affirmations, but not necessarily ending up where they want to be. You know those movies where the main character wakes up one day and sees that his life has not been worthwhile? He has always been besting people, not growing, learning, or caring. My favorite is Groundhog Day, which I didn't see for a long time because I couldn't get past the name. At any rate, in Groundhog Day, Bill Murray doesn't just wake up one day and get the message. He has to repeat the same day over and over until he gets the message. Phil Connors, Murray, is a weatherman for a local station in Pittsburgh, who is dispatched to Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, to cover the Groundhog Day ceremony. On February 2nd, a groundhog is taken out of his little house. If he is judged to have seen his shadow, there will be another 6 weeks of winter. If not, there will be an early spring. Phil, considering himself to be a superior being, has complete contempt for the ceremony, the town, and the people. Hicks and morons. And after making that perfectly clear, he plans to get out of Punxsutawney as quickly as possible. But this is not to be. A blizzard hits the town, he is forced to remain, and when he wakes up the next morning, it's Groundhog Day again. The same Sonny and Cher song, I Got You Babe, wakes him up on the clock radio, and the same Groundhog Festival is gearing up once again, and again, and again. At first, he uses the knowledge to further his typical agenda, making fools out of other people. Since he is the only one reliving the day, he can talk to a woman on one day, and then use the information to deceive, impress, and seduce her the next. He is in a fixed mindset heaven. He can prove his superiority over and over. But after countless such days, he realizes it's all going nowhere and he tries to kill himself. He crashes a car. He electrocutes himself. He jumps from a steeple. He walks in front of a truck. With no way out, it finally dawns on him. He could be using this time to learn. He goes for piano lessons. He reads voraciously. He learns ice sculpting. He finds out about people who need help that day, a boy who falls from a tree, a man who chokes on a stake, and starts to help them and care about them. Pretty soon, the day is not long enough. Only when this change of mindset is complete is he released from the spell. Question: are mindsets a permanent part of your makeup, or can you change them? Mindsets are an important part of your personality, but you can change them. Just by knowing about the two mindsets, you can start thinking and reacting in new ways. People tell me they start to catch themselves when they are in the throes of the fixed mindset, passing up a chance for learning, feeling labeled by a failure, or getting discouraged when something requires a lot of effort. And then they switch themselves into the growth mindset, making sure they take the challenge, learn from the failure, or continue their effort. When my graduate students and I first discovered the mindsets, they would catch me in the fixed mindset and scold me. It's also important to realize that even if people have a fixed mindset, they're not always in that mindset. In fact, in many of our studies, we put people into a growth mindset. We tell them that an ability can be learned and that the task will give them a chance to do that. Or we have them read a scientific article that teaches them the growth mindset. The article describes people who did not have natural ability, but who developed exceptional skills. These experiences make our research participants into growth-minded thinkers, at least for the moment. And they act like growth-minded thinkers, too. Later, there's a chapter all about change. There I describe people who have changed and programs we've developed to bring about change. Question: can I be half and half? I recognize both mindsets in myself. Many people have elements of both. I'm talking about it as a simple either-or for the sake of simplicity. People can also have different mindsets in different areas. I might think that my artistic skills are fixed, but that my intelligence can be developed, or that my personality is fixed, but my creativity can be developed. We found that whatever mindset people have in a particular area will guide them in that area. Question: with all your belief and effort, are you saying that when people fail, it's always their fault? They didn't try hard enough. No, it's true that effort is crucial. No one can succeed for long without it. But it's certainly not the only thing. People have different resources and opportunities. For example, people with money, or rich parents, have a safety net. They can take more risks and keep going longer until they succeed. People with easy access to a good education, people with a network of influential friends, people who know how to be in the right place at the right time, all stand a better chance of having their effort pay off. Rich, educated, connected effort works better. People with fewer resources, in spite of their best efforts, can be derailed so much more easily. The hometown plant you've worked in all of your life suddenly shuts down. What now? Your child falls ill and plunges you into debt. There goes the house. Your spouse runs off with the nest egg and leaves you with the children and bills. Forget the night school classes. Before we judge, let's remember that effort isn't quite everything, and that all effort is not created equal. Question. You keep talking about how the growth mindset makes people number one, the best, the most successful. Isn't the growth mindset about personal development, not besting others? I use examples of people who made it to the top to show how far the growth mindset can take you. Believing talents can be developed allows people to fulfill their potential. In addition, examples of laid-back people having a good time would not be as convincing to people with a fixed mindset. It doesn't provide a compelling alternative for them, because it makes it look like a choice between fun and excellence. However, this point is crucial. The growth mindset does allow people to love what they're doing, and to continue to love it in the face of difficulties. The growth-minded athletes, CEOs, musicians, or scientists all loved what they did, whereas many of the fixed-minded ones did not. Many growth-minded people didn't even plan to go to the top. They got there as a result of doing what they love. It's ironic. The top is where the fixed-mindset people hunger to be, but it's where many growth-minded people arrive as a byproduct of their enthusiasm for what they do. This point is crucial. In the fixed mindset, everything is about the outcome. If you fail, or if you're not the best, it's all been wasted. The growth mindset allows people to value what they're doing regardless of the outcome. They're tackling problems, charting new courses, working on important issues. Maybe they haven't found the cure for cancer, but the search was deeply meaningful. A lawyer spent 7 years fighting the biggest bank in his state on behalf of people who felt they'd been cheated. After he lost, he said, "Who am I to say that just because I spent 7 years on something, I am entitled to success? Did I do it for the success? Or did I do it because I thought the effort itself was valid? I do not regret it. I had to do it. I would not do it differently." Question. I know a lot of workaholics on the fast track who seem to have a fixed mindset. They're always trying to prove how smart they are, but they do work hard and they do take on challenges. How does this fit with your idea that people with a fixed mindset go in for low effort and easy tasks? On the whole, people with a fixed mindset prefer effortless success, since that's the best way to prove their talent. But you're right. There are also plenty of high-powered people who think their traits are fixed and are looking for constant validation. These may be people whose life goal is to win a Nobel Prize or become the richest person on the planet, and they're willing to do what it takes. We'll meet people like this in the chapter on business and leadership. These people may be free of the belief that high effort equals low ability, but they have the other parts of the fixed mindset. They may constantly put their talent on display. They may feel their talent makes them superior to other people. And they may be intolerant of mistakes, criticism, or setbacks, something that can hamper their progress. Incidentally, people with a growth mindset might also like a Nobel Prize or a lot of money, but they are not seeking it as a validation of their worth or as something that will make them better than others. Question. What if I like my fixed mindset? If I know what my abilities and talents are, I know where I stand, and I know what to expect. Why should I give that up? If you like it, by all means keep it. This book shows people they have a choice by spelling out the two mindsets and the worlds they create. The point is that people can choose which world they want to inhabit. The fixed mindset creates the feeling that you can really know the permanent truth about yourself, and this can be comforting. You don't have to try for such and such because you don't have the talent. You will surely succeed at thus and such because you do have the talent. It's just important to be aware of the drawbacks of this mindset. You may be robbing yourself of an opportunity by underestimating your talent in the first area. Or you may be undermining your chances of success in the second area by assuming that your talent alone will take you there. By the way, having a growth mindset doesn't force you to pursue something. It just tells you that you can develop your skills. It's still up to you whether you want to. Question. Can everything about people be changed? And should people try to change everything they can? The growth mindset is the belief that abilities can be cultivated, but it doesn't tell you how much change is possible or how long change will take. And it doesn't mean that everything, like preferences or values, can be changed. I was once in a taxi, and the driver had an opera on the radio. Thinking to start a conversation, I said, "Do you like opera?" "No," he replied. "I hate it. I've always hated it." "I don't mean to pry," I said, "but why are you listening to it?" He then told me how his father had been an opera buff, listening to his vintage records at every opportunity. My cab driver, now well into middle age, had tried for many years to cultivate a rapturous response to opera. He played the discs, he read the scores, all to no avail. "Give yourself a break," I advised him. "There are plenty of cultured and intelligent people who can't stand opera. Why don't you just consider yourself one of them?" The growth mindset also doesn't mean that everything that can be changed should be changed. We all need to accept some of our imperfections, especially the ones that don't really harm our lives or the lives of others. The fixed mindset stands in the way of development and change. The growth mindset is a starting point for change, but people need to decide for themselves where their efforts toward change would be most valuable. Question. Are people with the fixed mindset simply lacking in confidence? No. People with the fixed mindset have just as much confidence as people with the growth mindset, before anything happens, that is. But as you can imagine, their confidence is more fragile, since setbacks and even effort can undermine it. Joseph Martocchio conducted a study of employees who were taking a short computer training course. Half of the employees were put in a fixed mindset. He told them it was all a matter of how much ability they possessed. The other half were put in a growth mindset. He told them that computer skills could be developed through practice. Everyone, steeped in these mindsets, then proceeded with the course. Although the two groups started off with exactly equal confidence in their computer skills, by the end of the course they looked quite different. Those in the growth mindset gained considerable confidence in their computer skills as they learned, despite the many mistakes they inevitably made. But, because of those mistakes, those with the fixed mindset actually lost confidence in their computer skills as they learned. The same thing happened with Berkeley students. Richard Robbins and Jennifer Powles tracked students at the University of California at Berkeley over their years of college. They found that when students had the growth mindset, they gained confidence in themselves as they repeatedly met and mastered the challenges of the university. However, when students had the fixed mindset, their confidence eroded in the face of those same challenges. That's why people with the fixed mindset have to nurse their confidence and protect it. That's what John McEnroe's excuses were for, to protect his confidence. Michelle Wee is a teenage golfer who decided to go up against the big boys. She entered the Sony Open, a PGA tournament that features the best male players in the world. Coming from a fixed mindset perspective, everyone rushed to warn her that she could do serious damage to her confidence if she did poorly. That taking too many early lumps against superior competition could hurt her long-range development. "It's always negative when you don't win," warned Vijay Singh, a prominent golfer on the tour. But we disagreed. She wasn't going there to groom her confidence. Once you win junior tournaments, it's easy to win multiple times. What I'm doing now is to prepare for the future. It's the learning experience she was after. What it was like to play with the world's best players in the atmosphere of a tournament. After the event, Wee's confidence had not suffered one bit. She had exactly what she wanted. "I think I learned that I can play here. It will be a long road to the winner's circle," but she now had a sense of what she was shooting for. "Some years ago, I got a letter from a world-class competitive swimmer. Dear Professor Dweck, I've always had a problem with confidence. My coaches always told me to believe in myself 100%. They told me not to let any doubts enter my mind and to think about how I'm better than everyone else. I couldn't do it because I'm always so aware of my defects and the mistakes I make in every meet. Trying to think I was perfect made it even worse. Then I read your work and how it's so important to focus on learning and improving. It turned me around. My defects are things I can work on. Now a mistake doesn't seem so important. I wanted to write you this letter for teaching me how to have confidence. Thank you. Sincerely, Mary Williams. A remarkable thing I've learned from my research is that in the growth mindset, you don't always need confidence. What I mean is that even when you think you're not good at something, you can still plunge into it wholeheartedly and stick to it. Actually, sometimes you plunge into something because you're not good at it. This is a wonderful feature of the growth mindset. You don't have to think you're already great at something to want to do it and to enjoy doing it. This book is one of the hardest things I've ever done. I read endless books and articles. The information was overwhelming. I'd never written in a popular way. It was intimidating. Does it seem easy for me? Way back when, that's exactly what I would have wanted you to think. Now I want you to know the effort it took and the joy it brought. Grow your mindset. People are all born with a love of learning, but the fixed mindset can undo it. Think of a time you were enjoying something, doing a crossword puzzle, playing a sport, learning a new dance. Then it became hard and you wanted out. Maybe you suddenly felt tired, dizzy, bored, or hungry. Next time this happens, don't fool yourself. It's the fixed mindset. Put yourself in a growth mindset. Picture your brain forming new connections as you meet the challenge and learn. Keep on going. It's tempting to create a world in which we're perfect. I remember that feeling from grade school. We can choose partners, make friends, hire people who make us feel faultless. But think about it. Do you want to never grow? Next time you're tempted to surround yourself with worshipers, go to church. In the rest of your life, seek constructive criticism. Is there something in your past that you think measured you? A test score? A dishonest or callous action? Being fired from a job? Being rejected? Focus on that thing. Feel all the emotions that go with it. Now, put it in a growth mindset perspective. Look honestly at your role in it, but understand that it doesn't define your intelligence or personality. Instead, ask, what did I or can I learn from that experience? How can I use it as a basis for growth? Carry that with you instead. How do you act when you feel depressed? Do you work harder at things in your life or do you let them go? Next time you feel low, put yourself in a growth mindset. Think about learning, challenge, confronting obstacles. Think about effort as a positive, constructive force, not as a big drag. Try it out. Is there something you've always wanted to do but were afraid you weren't good at? Make a plan to do it. Chapter 3. The Truth About Ability and Accomplishment. Try to picture Thomas Edison as vividly as you can. Think about where he is and what he's doing. Is he alone? I asked people, and they always said things like this. He's in his workshop, surrounded by equipment. He's working on the phonograph, trying things. He succeeds. Is he alone? Yes, he's doing this stuff alone because he's the only one who knows what he's after. He's in New Jersey. He's standing in a white coat in a lab-type room. He's leaning over a light bulb. Suddenly it works. Is he alone? Yes, he's kind of a reclusive guy who likes to tinker on his own. In truth, the record shows quite a different fellow, working in quite a different way. Edison was not a loner. For the invention of the light bulb, he had 30 assistants, including well-trained scientists, often working around the clock in a corporate-funded state-of-the-art laboratory. It did not happen suddenly. The light bulb has become the symbol for that single moment when the brilliant solution strikes. But there was no single moment of invention. In fact, the light bulb was not one invention, but a whole network of time-consuming inventions, each requiring one or more chemists, mathematicians, physicists, engineers, and glassblowers. Edison was no naive tinkerer or unworldly egghead. The Wizard of Menlo Park was a savvy entrepreneur, fully aware of the commercial potential of his inventions. He also knew how to cozy up to the press, sometimes beating others out as the inventor of something because he knew how to publicize himself. Yes, he was a genius, but he was not always one. His biographer, Paul Israel, sifting through all the available information, thinks he was more or less a regular boy of his time and place. Young Tom was taken with experiments and mechanical things, perhaps more avidly than most. But machines and technology were part of the ordinary Midwestern boy's experience. What eventually set him apart was his mindset and drive. He never stopped being the curious, tinkering boy looking for new challenges. Long after other men had taken up their roles in society, he rode the rails from city to city, learning everything he could about telegraphy and working his way up the ladder of telegraphers through nonstop self-education and invention. And later, much to the disappointment of his wives, his consuming love remained self-improvement and invention, but only in his field. There are many myths about ability and achievement, especially about the lone, brilliant person suddenly producing amazing things. Yet Darwin's masterwork, The Origin of Species, took years of teamwork in the field, hundreds of discussions with colleagues and mentors, several preliminary drafts, and half a lifetime of dedication before it reached fruition. Mozart labored for more than 10 years until he produced any work that we admire today. Before then, his compositions were not that original or interesting. Naturally, they were often patched together chunks taken from other composers. This chapter is about the real ingredients in achievement. It's about why some people achieve less than expected and why some people achieve more. Mindset and school achievement. Let's step down from the celestial realm of Mozart and Darwin and come back to Earth to see how mindsets create achievement in real life. It's funny, but seeing one student blossom under the growth mindset has a greater impact on me than all the stories about Mozart's and Darwin's. Maybe because it's more about you and me, about what's happening to us and why we are where we are now, and about children and their potential. Back on Earth, we measured students' mindsets as they made the transition to junior high school. Did they believe their intelligence was a fixed trait or something they could develop? Then we followed them for the next 2 years. The transition to junior high is a time of great challenge for many students. The work gets much harder, the grading policies toughen up, the teaching becomes less personalized. And all this happens while students are coping with their new adolescent bodies and roles. Grades suffer, but not everyone's grades suffer equally. No, in our study, only the students with the fixed mindset showed the decline. They showed an immediate drop-off in grades, and slowly but surely did worse and worse over the 2 years. The students with the growth mindset showed an increase in their grades over the 2 years. When the two groups had entered junior high, their past records were indistinguishable. In the more benign environment of grade school, they'd earned the same grades and achievement test scores. Only when they hit the challenge of junior high did they begin to pull apart. Here's how students with the fixed mindset explained their poor grades. Many maligned their abilities. I'm the stupidest, or I suck in math. And many covered these feelings by blaming someone else. The math teacher's a fat male slut. And the English teacher's a slob with a pink ass. Because the teacher's on crack? These interesting analyses of the problem hardly provide a roadmap to future success. With the threat of failure looming, students with the growth mindset instead mobilized their resources for learning. They told us that they too sometimes felt overwhelmed, but their response was to dig in and do what it takes. They were like George Danzig. Who? George Danzig was a graduate student in math at Berkeley. One day, as usual, he rushed in late to his math class and quickly copied the two homework problems from the blackboard. When he later went to do them, he found them very difficult, and it took him several days of hard work to crack them open and solve them. They turned out not to be homework problems at all. They were two famous math problems that had never been solved. The low effort syndrome. Our students with the fixed mindset who were facing the hard transition saw it as a threat. It threatened to unmask their flaws and turn them from winners into losers. In fact, in the fixed mindset, adolescence is one big test. Am I smart or dumb? Am I good-looking or ugly? Am I cool or nerdy? Am I a winner or a loser? And in the fixed mindset, a loser is forever. It's no wonder that many adolescents mobilize their resources, not for learning, but to protect their egos. And one of the main ways they do this, aside from providing vivid portraits of their teachers, is by not trying. This is when some of the brightest students, just like Nadia Salerno-Sonnenberg, simply stop working. In fact,
students with the fixed mindset tell us that their main goal in school, aside from looking smart, is to exert as little effort as possible. They heartily agree with statements like this. In school, my main goal is to do things as easily as possible so I don't have to work very hard. This low effort